And the Oscar goes to...
The Oscar goes to...
And the Oscar goes to...
John Travolta, come on.
Sean Penn.
Charlize Theron.
Jamie Foxx.
Hilary Swank.
I'm just a girl from a trailer park who had a dream.
Academy Award winner Russell Crowe.
Academy Award winner Nicole Kidman.
Here is Jack Nicholson.
All right, welcome to Spoiler Alert. I'm Steve Haskin.
And I'm Andre Shane, and today we are not driving anywhere, uncharacteristically for us. We have just way too much paperwork, and the reason for that, of course, is that it's our sort of year overview pre-Oscar show.
It's also kind of our one-year anniversary.
That's right, so it's only appropriate that we are right back where we started, which is exciting. Congratulations on the one-year anniversary of our glorious Spoiler Alert program.
And to you.
Thank you. And, of course, again, we will be talking about some of the best films of the year, and specifically we'll kind of build it about the Oscar nominations.
Yeah.
So the best place to start is just Best Picture nominees, Steve. You know, again, 10 Best Picture nominees.
Yeah, the second time in the second year in a row now.
That's
there's
right.
been 10 rather than 5.
Mm-hmm. I like the nominees this year, Steve. I don't think there's any, like, obvious turkeys. I think this seems like a good crop of Best Picture nominees.
It's true. There's no film on that list that I'm like, what? What were they thinking?
No,
there's
not at
no
all.
Way.
Not at all. It's pretty solid. I mean, let's run it down. We got The Black Swan, we got The Fighter, we have Inception, The Kids Are All Right, The King's Speech, 127 Hours, Social Network, Toy Story 3. There is, of course,
and,
Winter's Bone and True Grit.
True Grit, yeah.
You know, what's funny to me about the 10 nominations, Steve, is like they've expanded the nominations to 10 for Best Picture, but everything else is still 5. So, particularly in the director's category, people get left out.
When there were 5 Best Picture nominees, it felt like every year that the directors and the Best Pictures never matched up exactly. There tended to be one difference.
Mm-hmm.
And it was one of those Oscar handicapping cliches that if you were a director nominated and your film was not nominated, then people were like, well, you're probably not going to win. But it would happen all the time. And then vice versa, it was weird to have a picture that the Academy felt was one of the best pictures of the year, and yet apparently the director was not one of the best directors of the year.
Right, right.
Now we have that problem times two.
Right.
Because, you know, you're pretty much guaranteed that everybody in the directing category, they have a film in there, but that means there's 5 other directors who are not.
The glaring omission from the director's category this year for me is Christopher Nolan for Inception. That's mainly due to the fact that I think Inception is just a wildly original film. So right away, I'll start with a little quibble about the director category, where I think that somebody could have been left off of amongst the group that's there now to make room for Nolan, simply because I think you have to tip your hat to the accomplishment, sheer scope of the accomplishment for Inception. And the movie is extremely complex. Extremely complex to make. He's one of the writers of the film. I mean, it's hard to not give him due for Inception while giving, like, well, who could have they left off, Steve? What do you think?
Well, my vote, as surprising as it would seem to people who know me, is I would probably take the Coen brothers off. That Lord knows I love the Coen brothers. I'm on record that in general the Coen brothers are kind of my favorite filmmakers. But talking about 2010, Inception was a better achievement to me than True Grit was.
Yeah.
I mean, I enjoyed True Grit. It was a solid movie, had some great moments, but, you know, I wasn't blown away by the command of the direction. Whereas opposed to, say, No Country for Old Men, I thought, you know, like, wow, that's an achievement in direction.
Right.
You're, like, impressed by it. And Inception's a great movie to talk about and argue about. And, you know, there's certainly aspects of that movie where people like to debate how the world of Inception works and this or that logical hole in the movie. But nobody really finds Inception incoherent.
No.
Like you say, for such a complicated movie, I mean, the thing flows and you can follow it and debate it. And, you know, Steven Soderbergh a couple of years ago won an Academy Award for Traffic. And I feel that that award was basically for logistics as opposed to anything else. Like, I think that's a flawed movie, but just the logistics of that movie, people were like, wow, you know, good job, Steven Soderbergh, orchestrating all that. And, you know, the degree of difficulty for Inception was a lot higher.
I agree with you, and I would kind of agree with the Coen brothers being your choice to sort of being replaced by Nolan in this particular case, because True Grit, without a question, is the Coen brothers' like probably least ambitious film.
I do love that there's certain filmmakers and actors who it seems that everything they do gets nominated. I mean, you know, Meryl Streep's been in that category for a long time. There was a period of time where Woody Allen was in that category.
Right, that's over.
It is over. So I am amused by the fact that the Coen brothers seem to be in that category a little bit, that it, you know, I enjoy. Like, well, let's just give the Coen brothers a nomination.
Right. Well, I think ultimately they're more deserving than Woody Allen, let's say.
Well, exactly. I mean, if you're going to throw out a, like, instant nomination, I think they deserve it more than most people. But
yeah, true. You know, but yeah. I think in this case, I think Nolan should have been thrown a bone.
Also, it's, you know, this is going back to the directors who have Best Picture nominees but aren't nominated. You know, it is true that they're two, the ladies were left off. Either Lisa Chilodenko and Deborah Granik, who made Kids Are All Right and Winter's Bone, respectively.
Right.
They were left off. I mean, I would have, you know, apart from Nolan, I would have put Deborah Granik on there because, I mean, Winter's Bone was, frankly, my favorite movie of the year. That was my top prize winner.
Winter's Bone, wildly original film, very well directed, without a lot of gimmickry, just good, straight-up drama, very good.
And the Academy agreed, you know, it got a Best Picture nominee, so the actors are nominated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the movie got its acknowledgement, and I'm sure Deborah Granik is very, very pleased with it, because she's now one of those filmmakers who's been, you know, has gotten a lot of Academy Awards love in her past career. I think this is her second film or something like that. So,
but Deborah Granik's exclusion is more unsurprising, I guess, is the word I would say. But Nolan is a bit more surprising.
I would agree. And, you know, there's a lot of talk this year about the lack of, quote-unquote, diversity in all Oscar categories, pretty much. And here, by including somebody like Deborah Granik, they could have, like, combated a lot of that. Because Catherine Bigelow won last year, was a big thing. And this year, we have two films that are both successful commercially and artistically, directed by women, and yet it's all guys.
Yeah, we're
the
right
best
back.
Director yeah. field. So I think the best director category was a major kind of disappointment in many ways in terms of the people that got nominated. And I think there was there's a lot of issues I have with that particular category.
But as always with the Oscars, and this is something I'm actually charmed by, and I think you are as well, I love the whole politics of the Oscars. For example, Nolan wasn't nominated. I think he should have been nominated. Did I think in a million years Nolan was going to win?
No.
No. So it's like, well, then there's the cliche, it's always an honor to be nominated, but at the same time, like, well, he wasn't invited to a party. He wasn't going to win anyway.
It's hard to really gauge who will actually win. You know, it's funny because I always feel like I'm pretty good at predicting the Oscars. But based on the recent, like, the awards season, like yesterday, I watched the Screen Actors Guild Award presentation. And yesterday, the big winner, there were obviously exceptions, but the big winner was The King's Speech. The King's Speech is such a major spoiler this year in the Best Of category because The King's Speech is a Weinstein Brothers company and formerly, of course, Miramax. And those guys are known for, I don't know what it is they do exactly, but they seem to have the ability to lobby the Academy to get not just nominations, but wins for movies that ordinarily would win the Oscar. And I don't want to be unfair to The King's Speech. It's the only nominee that I have not seen this year. And I know you haven't seen it either. And I'm going to just come right out and say I don't particularly want to see it either. I have no desire to see it, even though I know the people have seen it, said it was terrific.
I'm almost at the point where I refuse to see it. I've almost got a personal slash political thing against the King's Speech for some of the reasons you just mentioned. It's almost every year, but there, you know, like you say, a lot of times these movies come out from Miramax and or the Weinstein Company. I'm talking about movies like The Reader, The Queen, Chocolat, maybe Finding Neverland. Mm-hmm. You know, so there are these
maybe
movies.
Maybe The English Patient.
Yeah, yeah. And these movies come out, and they're perfectly fine. And they usually have some excellent performances, and they look great, and they're tasteful. And all this stuff I'm saying, at least for me personally, equates to boring. It's just, it's middle brow, it's boring. You watch it, and I guess it's enjoyable. There's a movie like this every year,
mm-hmm.
and next year there'll be another one. And people can't even remember the movie in this category from the year before.
They can't.
And you can say this about other genres. You know, there's action movies. You know, say you like movies with car chases. And you're like, sure. So then, you know, you watch the Fast and the Furious or whatever.
Death
and
Race.
Then, take your pick. And then, you know, next year, you're like, man, I haven't seen a good car chase movie in a while, and there's a car chase movie for you.
That's
like, all right.
There's one coming up with Nicolas Cage, right? What is it called? Drive Angry?
Drive Angry.
Oh, that looks good.
But with those movies, they don't have any pretensions, and nobody right. thinks, like, we have to award every, like, wow, that was the best movie of that year.
Right, right, right.
And with these, like, you know, Oscar bait movies, I don't know. It's just so boring and unexciting artistically, and part of me just thinks, who cares? And specifically with this movie, The King's Speech. You know, let's say I told you about a movie about a super rich guy. I mean, we're talking, never has to work another day in his life, but he's really fat.
And not a self-made rich guy, just inherited the money.
Sure.
He was born into it.
Oh, yeah, great. Even so, he's a trust fund kid. They get a kick-ass personal trainer for him. And then at the end of the movie, he's not fat anymore.
That's right. And in the process, he develops a warm, understanding, close relationship with his personal trainer.
Yeah.
And like the last shot of the movie is they high-five each other.
Yeah.
Slow-mo and the credits roll over the freeze frame.
Yeah, or maybe he's a really smart guy and he was, you know, they wanted him to be on Wheel of Fortune, but he didn't want to because he was too fat. But now he can be on TV and feel good about himself because he's not fat. I mean, that sounds terrible, right? I mean, it sounds like a terrible movie.
Yeah.
And to me, The King's Speech is, I mean, it's the same thing. We give a guy who's
with a speech
he's filthy rich, and his big tragic flaw is he stammers. I mean, I'm sorry. I know there are people, if you're a stammerer, there's frustration at, you know, how it's hard to communicate with people, but, I mean, a little perspective here. You know, you're a stammerer. And so they find a speech therapist for him. I mean, oh, wow. So the King of England is able to find a successful speech therapist. How'd they ever, you know,
right.
he can afford the best speech therapist in the entire world.
Yeah. And
the climax of the movie is he can deliver a speech without stammering.
Yeah, which is another, like, little thing. You got this historical fact that the king delivered this speech. It was a fine speech. It inspired the British people. Although, you know, the King of England, even at that time, was a symbolic figure. And, you know, I'd be more interested to hear how Winston Churchill came out with his speech that really, really united
sure.
his country and really drew a line in the sand against the greatest evil of that time. That would have been more interesting. And this, too, I don't know. It's.
All right, you know, I mean. I take Hitler's speech over that.
You know
what I mean, like,
whoa.
Well, those are more effective speeches, right? I mean, let's talk about the speeches of a man who turned an entire country crazy. I mean, like,
that's a speech.
That's more interesting, right, than a stammer.
Hitler's speech. I'm telling them. Listen, that's not going to win any Oscars, but that's
see, that would be that would there. That would not fall into the safe middle brown category. It would maybe be a little edgier.
Well, I'm thinking we should make a parody of the King's Speech with actually Hitler, and Hitler has to overcome his own, you know, fears of public speaking in order to make his virulently anti-Semitic, warmongering speeches.
Maybe that'd we could do the governor's speech. We could do a Sarah Palin speech where she gets all her facts right. Like, that's the big climax of the movie, is, like, she delivers several points on foreign policy.
That's right.
And she doesn't, like, mumble something. You know, like, they're actually correct.
Right, right, right. And she has to hire some extremely liberal,
yeah,
you know, fact checker.
Bond.
And they develop a bond. on. Yeah, something along those lines.
All of these things sound more interesting to me than the King's Speech.
I agree.
And so, especially this year, I mean, I don't know, I would probably have the same argument any year, but this year there's several. I mean, there's not just one. You know, there are multiple Best Picture nominees that I find way more exciting and fulfilling on an artistic level, you know, as a viewer, just much better movies. And when I look back at 2010, I'll be like, oh, yeah, I remember The Social Network.
Yes.
I love Winter's Bone. You know, oh, yeah. Black Swan. I really enjoyed that film. Like, that to me, I'll remember those films. I'll probably watch those films again for years. The King's Speech, I mean, next year there's going to be, you know, The Duchess's Pudding or something. And it's going to come out, and Judi Dench will be in it.
I think that's an adult film, but that's out already, Dave. But I know your point is well taken. There's this cacophony of what I call, like, these parlor dramas. They're, you know, most of them are British. Many of them are produced by Miramax/Weinstein Company. And they are literally... they seem to exist for no other purpose than to collect Oscars. My guess is that Harvey Weinstein just has he just has dirt on every single member of the Academy, so he can literally call up anybody who votes in any single category and say, hey, remember that hooker you killed back in 79? We can still keep that a secret if the King's Speech wins. So that's just my own conspiracy theory. I may be wrong. I'm not suggesting anybody in the Academy has, you know, those kind of skeletons in his closet, although I'm pretty sure they do. But many, at least, you know. But,
well, I mean, this year when that movie first started to come out, I thought, you know, The Social Network, ever since it came out, was touted as a front runner.
Right.
And it's still prohibitively the favorite. But The King's Speech has been winning a lot of awards, and I got to say, I'll be upset if The King's Speech wins.
I think I'll be upset too. And I think if it does win, I think people will look back on The King's Speech and will look back on this year the same way they look back on The English Patient, which, once you strip away all the hoopla and all the awards and you actually take the film for what it is slow and pretentious, and it may not be bad per se, but it's certainly not Oscar material. And, you know, the Academy Awards are just filled with the examples of films that, just like, when you sort of look back and you go, huh, are you serious? Oliver? Have you seen Oliver? Are you kidding? I mean, it's the same kind of thing. They seem to be overly impressed by English accents. They seem to be kind of blown away by costumes and so on and so forth. And then they kind of forget, like, hey, is this going to be a film that's moving the art form forward? I mean, is this going to be a film that's going to excite people in 10, 15, 20 years? Or are you giving it to comfort food? The King's Speech could have been made in 85, 75, 65, 55, 45, probably even 35. And it would have been literally exactly the same film. And people like that sort of classic feel, but it seems to downplay stuff that really kind of is avant-garde. And that's what I respect. And the 10 categories, the 10 nominees for Best Picture this year, there's some really kind of avant-garde type films, and the top of which, to me, is definitely The Social Network. But you could say, you know, 127 Hours is a kind of a wacky film that's out there. You
sure.
Know, very stylistically impressive. The Black Swan certainly has its stuff. But if all you want is just straight-up solid drama, I would say The Fighter is a classic.
Yeah, I mean, The Fighter's a movie we both enjoyed, and
yeah.
But I mean, also, The Fighter is not groundbreaking.
No, it's not groundbreaking. It's just solid. It's solid genre film. It does everything a sports film is supposed to do, and the crowd loves it. I mean, the theater that I saw it in was just, people just were having a great time with the film. They were laughing, they were enjoying themselves, they were kind of moved by it, they were clapping for when Mark Wahlberg was winning the fight, and they were shocked when he was losing the fight. It had all of the elements that a movie like that needs to have, and it has,
plus crack addiction
on top of that. Well, the that's that performance in that film is actually kind of staggering. I think Christian Bale is unquestionably going to win. He's won all the other awards, and he deserves it. It's kind of a monumental performance. I don't want to overstate it. What's great about the performance is that it's broad, it's over the top, it's daring because it is so broad and over the top, and at the same time, it's very fitting into the rest of the picture. And on top of all that, it has an entertainment value. It's genuinely entertaining. You watch it, you're into it, you get what he's doing, you're smiling at the stuff that's supposed to be funny, you're moved by the stuff that's not supposed to be funny, and all of that works remarkably well. I think The Fighter is going to win acting awards for Bale, and I think it's going to win an acting award for Melissa Leo, who's also fantastic in the film. But the movie has no chance of doing this come from behind thing. I think there's no swing for it.
And you can argue that the David O. Russell's nomination is for the performances.
Yeah, absolutely.
He did a good job. And Christian Bale's performance, how you were saying, is kind of broad. It's like an old school Daniel Day-Lewis performance. Mm-hmm. Where it's big, but it fits in, and unlike in There Will Be Blood, where Daniel Day-Lewis is, kind of big and just chewing up everything in sight.
Yeah, it's like the supernova that eats up the rest of the film. Well, where in this case, it's not. It just supports the film, and it's
and
exactly
partly
what
that's
it
Christian
to be.
Bale's to his credit, but it's also to David O. Russell's credit for not letting that performance just subsume everything in its wake.
Absolutely, and just fit and seem organic and just work very well. David O. Russell, very well deserving of the Best Director nomination this year because this could have been a very, very standard film, no big deal, just good, solid, blah, blah, blah. And I think it's a little more than that. I think it's actually excellent. And I think it's a kind of film that years from now people are going to go, oh, yeah, The Fighter, loved that film. Yeah, people are just going to have a relationship with that movie. And I'm not sure who the hell is going to have the relationship with, I don't know, Black Swan. I don't know. If you have a serious emotional connection to Black Swan,
I might have a relationship with Black Swan.
Oh my God.
I love Black Swan.
Well, I don't know. You and I disagree on that a little bit. I think The Black Swan is flawed. I'm not surprised it got nominated, but I just think it's flawed. I think it has a very, very limited target that it went for. I think it nailed that target, but that target was so tiny that it would have been almost nice if they just kind of expanded the target and said, okay, what if it wasn't just an exploration of the psychological disintegration of Nina, the main character? What if we actually try to say something a little bit more about art, about the nature of performance, about ballet, about dance? I mean, you name it. They could have kind of opened it up a little bit. Instead, Darren Aronofsky just definitively had a very narrow, small target that he was shooting for, and he nailed that target. But for me, that target just wasn't quite enough for me to love the film.
Well, let's talk about some of the other movies we enjoy that weren't on the Best Picture list. Because I know, Andre, you have a couple films that you had even in your top 10 that were not.
Yeah. The first one that's kind of way off the beaten track is a movie called The Killer Inside Me. And this is a movie that Michael Winterbottom did. And I like Michael Winterbottom, especially when Michael Winterbottom is making, entertaining films as opposed to political films. I think he's a shit political filmmaker. But when he makes artistic films, there's a lot. He's great. And The Killer Inside Me is an adaptation of a Jim Thompson novel by the same name, and it's actually been made before. It was there was a version of Killer Inside Me with Stacy Keach done in the early 70s, and it's really bad. And this version starts Casey Affleck, who I really like as an actor.
Yeah, me too.
And it's got an excellent cast across the board. But this is one of those films that it's a tough sell. I would never suggest that a movie like The Killer Inside Me should be nominated for Best Picture, because if you see that film, you'll know right away. I mean, it's brutal. It's very disturbing. It's a noir. Jim Thompson was one of these guys. He wrote sort of character studies of criminals, and he himself was a very troubled individual. Also dabbled in film as well. He wrote a Stanley Kubrick picture called The Killing. He also wrote another Stanley Kubrick picture, which is called Paths of Glory, which is completely different from anything Jim Thompson's ever done. But Jim Thompson's work It has a very specific tone. It's different than people expect it. And the other aspect of Jim Thompson, all of his novels, is they tend to really go off the rails. They go into this crazy direction, for the most part, towards the end, that really, really, it separates him from other writers. And a lot of people think that he was one of these guys, and he had, I believe he had alcohol and drug problems, and a lot of people sort of write him off for that reason, because they just feel like he loses interest in his own work, when in reality, I thought there was a very specific point to how he wrote his books. And the way it relates to movies is that many of his novels have been adapted to film, but usually they're kind of weak. There are exceptions. There have been excellent versions. I actually kind of like Steve McQueen's version of The Getaway, and The Grifters is also a prime example of a fine adaptation of a Jim Thompson novel. But in this case, The Killer Inside Me, very, very good, very disturbing, but it nails the tone. It is very engaging, very well acted, and I just loved it. It's certainly not for everybody. It's really, really brutal. It has a scene that probably is as intensely violent as anything I've ever seen on film. So fair warning to anybody who's planning to rent this film. But I thought that was one of the best films of the year. What else, Steve?
Another movie I had and as one of my favorites. Again. Similar to that, though in a very different way, I'm not surprised this was not a Best Picture nomination, was Scott Pilgrim vs. the World. It's the latest film by Edgar Wright, who did Shaun of the Dead and Hot Fuzz. Mm-hmm. I think he's a very original, exciting new young filmmaker. Very funny, timing's great. Not just comedic timing, but he's a very cinematic way of making comedies. It's not just your kind of Judd Apatow. I like Judd Apatow movies for the most part, but like a lot of comedies, let's face it, they're not visually distinctive.
Exactly. They're written. All in the writing.
By design, those movies are shot with multiple cameras to allow for improvisation, and there's not a ton of camera movement or even stylistic editing, and Edgar Wright is not from that school. He makes movies. And Scott Pilgrim vs. the World is a very original take where the movie, it's based on a comic book, but the movie is more video games are the reference point.
That's the assumption.
And while there's been a lot of movies based on video games, this is a movie where the main character kind of treats his whole world, his life, as if his life is one big video game. And so when good things happen, he gets bonus points, coins add up, and he has villains to vanquish, and when he vanquishes the villains, they turn into coins. And the movie is really, it's very hyper, especially at the beginning. It reminded me a little bit of Moulin Rouge, that when it started, I wasn't sure, just me personally, if I could take 90 minutes of Scott Pilgrim battering away at me, but it calms down a little bit, and it's great. It's an exciting twist on the quirky indie romantic comedy, and I recommend Scott Pilgrim.
It's terrific. It's on my list too, yeah. Steve. And the only thing I would say is, this film is wildly original, and that is so rare. People say that movies are certainly original, but if you really break it down, they very rarely are. And here is a movie that is just, it's out there. It's really, really different from anything I've ever seen. And I've seen a lot of movies. And in a good way, not like quirkiness for the sake of quirkiness, but really a well-rounded, kind of unified artistic vision for this. And Edgar Wright brings it off beautifully. And it's, again, not for everybody. I'm positive, obviously. First of all, the movie was kind of a bomb. It did not make a lot of money.
No, it didn't do very well at all.
Which is surprising to me because it's a very lovable movie. But it's not for everybody. But the people that it's for, the age group that it's for, should have run out and seen this movie. I think this, if you've ever played a video game, if you've ever read a comic book, and if you've ever been in love, and you are between the ages of, 18 and 40, you would dig this movie. It's right up your alley. So check it out on video. I really, really recommend it to people. It is just a wonderful wild ride and a very lovable picture. The other film, I have a few of these more unusual films on the list, but this Danish movie called Valhalla Rising by a director that I really like. His name is Nicholas Winding Refn, and he did a movie I really liked last year called Bronson. He's a very gifted filmmaker because he just makes these different movies. Well, Valhalla Rising, it's a genuinely weird film. It doesn't have a lot of dialogue. It's about these Vikings who just recently converted to Christianity, and they sort of go on a pilgrimage to Jerusalem. And they get in a boat, a small boat, and they just go like, okay, we're going, God's going to take us to Jerusalem. Well, God does not take them to Jerusalem. God takes them to the Americas, which is, of course, pre-Columbus, and, madness ensues. And again, like most of my kind of off-kilter choices, this is off-kilter. This is not a film for everybody. This is not a film that everybody's going to love. But what Refn does in this film is it's a film that reminded me of Tarkovsky. It's a film that reminded me of Malick. It's a film that reminded me of Kubrick. And these are, you know, some of my favorite filmmakers in a very good way. I don't think he rips off those filmmakers. I think he genuinely does something new, but he works in that sandbox. They're metaphysical. They are philosophical. There's a concept behind what he's trying to say, and it's not necessarily a simplistic concept. It's not something that jumps out at you or beats you over the head, but it is a terrific film, and I really, really recommend it. And it has a couple of things that a lot of people like, which is it has some really cool action scenes, and on top of that, it has a great performance at the center, completely silent performance by Mads Mikkelsen, who most Americans know from the James Bond film Casino Royale, where he played the main villain, Le Chiffre. He's a great actor. He's just a wonderful actor, and he's one of those guys who carries the film without saying anything. He's mute in that film. And that's quite a feat these days, to have a center character who says nothing, but yet is extremely expressive, but in a very laconic way. Sort of reminded me of Clint Eastwood in those old Sergio Leone films, where very little dialogue, but you look at him and you know what he's thinking, without too much expression, without doing the silent acting thing. So, Valhalla Rising, check it out. Very fun film. So the other film that I want to mention is a documentary called Exit Through the Gift Shop, and that's actually been nominated for the Best Documentary. It's interesting to me that right now animated films are sliding into the Best Picture category, but documentaries are not quite there.
That's,
you know,
true.
But in this case, I think Exit Through the Gift Shop has so much entertainment value to it, and is so fun and enjoyable, and yet at the same time has a lot of depth to it, that I think it's clearly one of the best films of the year. I hope it wins the Best Documentary category. I'm not sure it will. In fact, I don't think it will, because it's not a movie that's trying to change the world. It doesn't have a social or political agenda. It is a movie about sort of the nature of art, and that's the kind of stuff that usually does not excite the Academy, because, well, I don't know why it doesn't excite the Academy.
It does excite us.
It certainly excites us, and it excites me, and that's a great film. I just say, you know, a lot of documentaries have a quality of kind of medicine to them. It's like, watch it, it's good for you. You'll learn something. It'll change your perspective on the world. I'm not sure that Exit Through the Gift Shop will change your perspective on the world. What Exit Through the Gift Shop does very well is entertain you. And at the same time, it has this sort of sneaky message at the end, again, dealing with the nature of art. And at this, and another level of Exit Through the Gift Shop is it has an element of kind of a hoax to it. I'm still not 100% sure how real some of the stuff in Exit Through the Gift Shop is. Like, how are they? Is that seriously how the film came about? Is that the film starts out as one thing and then it literally takes a sharp left turn and becomes completely another film, focusing on a completely other thing that it was focusing on before? So, So, Exit Through the Gift Shop, great film, very entertaining, and not medicine-y at all. Just a fun time of the movies.
This year is unusual in terms of the Best Picture nominees. That the Best Picture nominees and most of the critical awards throughout the country, and indeed the majority, at least, of your and my list, are all kind of in sync. You know, we're not blown away by the inappropriateness of anything on the list, despite our lack of excitement about the King's Speech.
Right.
But so, what were some films this year that you thought were overrated? Got really great reviews and you just didn't do it for you? Or
I think A Black Swan's a little overrated. Not massively, but a little bit. I think Toy Story 3 not that I didn't like Toy Story 3, I just felt that Toy Story 3 wasn't as good as Toy Story 1 or Toy Story 2. Toy Story 3, in and of itself, is fine. It's a fine cartoon. It's an entertaining family picture. My kids love it. They've seen it a few times now. We bought it on DVD, so they watch it, you know, fairly regularly and enjoy it. Adults like it because there's some, you know, there's resonant themes in the film. I just don't think it's all that. Much like Up before it, I think there's sort of this knee-jerk adulation for anything that comes out of the Pixar studios. And Pixar studios have a fantastic track record. There's no question about that.
Yeah, I love the Pixar movies. And if any studio has earned the benefit of the doubt, it's Pixar. And not that they've ever made necessarily a bad movie. I agree with you that Pixar, though, you know, anytime they put out anything, it's almost like a race to be the first critic to proclaim that movie a new modern classic.
Yeah.
And I'm right in sync with you on Up, that I thought Up was not really all that great a movie. Watched it again recently with my family and found the whole thing, you know, just okay. Mm-hmm. Not all that great.
Yeah.
I disagree with you on Toy Story 3, though. I actually thought that movie was really great. It's for what wound up being, you know, the third part of a trilogy, which was not the original concept of the Toy Story movies, mm-hmm. I found Toy Story 3 to be more satisfying as a final chapter than most third parts of trilogies. That the ending and the resolution of the character story in Toy Story 3 felt authentic, it felt earned, and maybe precisely because it wasn't a trilogy going in, I didn't know where it was going. I mean, it's not, you know, it's still a kid's movie. So
sure,
it hits its beats and, you know, there's some mild danger and, you know, the toys have to get out of it and it doesn't blow you away. But in terms of the resolution of how the story with Andy goes, it went in some directions I didn't entirely expect and felt very emotionally satisfying for me at the end of that movie. And I've continued to be impressed with the three Toy Story movies that, you know, say this recent Star Trek reboot or Iron Man or Batman Begins the Dark Knight. All of those movies, when they made those movies, they, from the get-go, the producers thought, all right, if this hits, we're going to make three of them.
Right.
You know, like they signed the actors to three-picture deals. And you know, you can argue with any movie, if it's successful, they talk about doing a sequel. But, you know, Toy Story came out. Toy Story was not designed to be part one of a trilogy or anything. And then Toy Story 2 came out, and, you know, fair, not too long after Toy Story 1. But Toy Story 3, it's been a big gap between 2 and 3. And, you know, the genesis of this movie, I had to think, was just a lazy cash grab. That the people at Pixar, as innovative and imaginative as they seem, I mean, I get the picture they were sitting around brainstorming, like, all right, what's our next movie going to be? And since nobody had an idea, they're like, well, why don't we do a third Toy Story? Which seems really cynical.
And, it is.
I mean, maybe that's not how it went down, but, you know, it's easy on paper to be like, really? You're cranking out another one of these? I mean, you know, not to name names, but, yeah, let's name names. Let's call it the Shrek series.
Right.
The Shrek franchise looks like where they just crank that crap out.
Yeah, it's a money printing machine that has absolutely no care in the world about any kind of artistic integrity or even intrinsic integrity. Whatever.
Yeah, so I'm very impressed by the Pixar people for the care they put into these Toy Story movies.
Right.
That it feels like it's its own film and that, you know, just as much love and attention to detail as the first one.
Right, right.
I like that movie more than you do.
You do.
I like
you
Black
do like
Swan
it.
More than you do.
You do like it more. I just don't see how Toy Story 3 belongs on the best picture list, even when there's 10 nominees. It seems gratuitous to me.
Well, let me go to a movie then that I felt was overrated, that you like better than I do, and then you can defend it.
Okay.
And that's The Kids Are All Right.
Okay.
I saw that recently, and... my gut reaction to that film is parts of it are really good, parts of it are kind of terrible to me. Hmm. So at the end of the day, it's all right.
Right.
some of it's just the Californianess of it, that, you know, the people in that film are almost in a foreign country compared to my life. And Annette Bening's character, Nick, right? Is that her name?
I don't know.
Annette Bening's character has a scene in a restaurant where she acknowledges, you know, some of the Californianess of the characters. But, you know, a lot of the dialogue in that film is kind of clunky. The basic setup is fairly, you know, if it wasn't about a lesbian couple, I mean, the whole plot is something you've seen a million times before, where, you know, adopted children try and find their...
It's a sitcom.
Sitcom setup. Yeah. Dialogue's a little clunky. On the other hand, you know, I like all the actors in it. Some of the dialogue was quite moving. The performances were great. The characters are not, you know, or at least a lot of the characters, but, you know, Julianne Moore and Mark Ruffalo's characters are interesting in that they both do things that are quite admirable, and they also do some things that are quite despicable.
Mm-hmm.
But, I don't know, but it's also a movie where we have things where the teenage son's friend says, "Let's piss on the dog's head." And I can't conceive of any, like, that was the motivating scene for him to finally blow off his loser friend. And I just don't know of a world where that happens. And I mean, I guess his reaction to that was
authentic. If you really
don't
like the dog, Steve, I mean, honestly, if your cat approaches me one more time, I might actually take a whiz on her. I think your criticism is well taken. I will, for me, that movie is, it's not groundbreaking. It's not pushing the envelope at all. What it is for me is just very solidly entertaining. I remember when I watched it, I enjoyed it from beginning to end. I don't think it was pretentious. I don't think it was trying to pretend to be something it's not. I like the fact that it wasn't sanctimonious. I like the fact that it didn't have a quote-unquote political agenda. I mean, here's a movie about same-sex couple, and it was treated in a very casual kind of no big deal manner that I really appreciated, because that's how it should be treated. It shouldn't be some kind of a diatribe for gay rights or anything.
I mean, you could
like
argue
that
was the political agenda.
Well, perhaps.
I'm 100% with you.
True, but that's
the agenda.
But that's how political agendas should be handled in films, in my opinion. On top of that, I just found it entertaining. I didn't find the dialogue clunky. I found the dialogue pretty clever, and combined with good performances by everybody, not just the leads. I thought the kids were very good. I thought the little episodic performances were very solid. I thought there was a lot of emotional truth in it. I thought it was consistently funny. I thought there were more laughs in this movie than in a lot of comedies I see on a regular basis. And I just thought it was just solid, just very, very consistently solid from beginning to end. Again, if there were 5 nominees, I don't think I would put this movie on the best of list. It seems like a small film. It does seem sitcom-y, and it does seem a little bit trite in some of its human drama. There's nothing that earth-shattering going on. On the other hand, it would, again, I think the consistency of it, I think the performances, and just the entertainment value of it, I think kind of goes a long way. And I think Lisa Chulidenko, I've liked her work before, and I want to see more of what she's got in store.
Oh, I mean, that part is great. It's true. I have also liked some of her earlier movies better than this one. And, you know, like, that movie also suffered for me a little bit from expectations. That was a movie that, based on the cast and having liked the director's work before and the reviews and talking to people I knew who saw it before I did, I kind of really went into that movie
expecting a masterpiece.
I wanted to, well, not even a masterpiece, but wanting to love it.
Right.
Like, you know, to fall in love with that movie. And I just did it.
Didn't happen. Yeah, I could see that. I think it was a little bit overblown on the critical end. I think it got just too many accolades. And I think sometimes that could hurt a film. Yeah. I think if that film was advertised as just a fun, rompy, kind of pseudo-sex comedy, I think it would have probably done better business. And I think it would have snuck up on people and it would have seemed underrated instead of overrated, as it was to someone like you or me to some extent, when, you know, you hear these unbelievable reviews and then you see it and you go, eh, okay, it's good. That kind of becomes its own thing. You know, it becomes its own overrated thing. And I'm not sure if that's a fair way to approach it, but what can you do? Yeah, I mean, you sort of absorb. You don't just absorb the film itself, you have to absorb the reactions to the film and how the media treats the film and how the critics treat the film and how the film does. I mean, I think all of that comes into play, at least when I look at movies, and there's some to be said for that. And I think actually a good example of that is True Grit, which is a fine picture. It's just nowhere nearly the picture that people give it credit for. I mean, I think it's a straight up Western. I think it's solid. I think it's probably the Coen brothers, maybe their least interesting film in many ways. I mean, even Burn After Reading, which is kind of goofy, and there's other silly Coen brothers movies that are far worse than True Grit, obviously. But I think it's a fairly unambitious picture. And I liked it, I enjoyed it, but, you know, it left me kind of cold. I was really surprised. I think the weaknesses of the Coen brothers, which is, or at least the perceived weaknesses that a lot of people give them, is sort of this lack of this emotional detachment they have from a lot of their characters, I think kind of worked against them. I think this movie needed to have more emotional punch in it, and it didn't. It really didn't. I really was not... You know, that relationship between the main character, Rooster Cogburn, really the main character is the girl, and the relationship between her and this grizzled old murderer that she hired to capture and or kill her father's assassin is, I think it should have been stronger. I think there should have been more kind of emotional heft to it, and there really wasn't. Again, the movie is good. It's got, you know, it's thoughtful. It's got wonderful performances in it, but nothing amazing. So I think a little bit overrated on True Grit. Amazingly, it's the Coen brothers' most successful film ever. Ever. Like, by far and away. By like 200%. This movie is still making money. People seem to love it. So obviously it speaks on a deep level to the audience. It didn't particularly speak on a deep level to me. I don't know what it says. Again, this is another one of Coen Brothers, like, you know, they're hip and they're kind of arch and blah, blah, blah. And at the same time, their themes tend to be extremely conservative and old world. And this is a prime example of that. I mean, this is perhaps the general American audience, at least, is kind of... yearning for the times past when things guys were good and the bad guys were ugly and bad.
I mean, I gotta say, as a Coen Brother fan, the box office success or failure of Coen Brothers films, I'm the worst. perhaps the biggest exception was No Country for Old Men, where that movie did pretty well.
That movie did pretty well.
And that was a movie that, you know, I really enjoyed. But, you know, a lot of people went and saw that movie, and there's some general audience members who were kind of frustrated by it.
Oh, yeah. It was frustrating.
That said, for a lot of times, you know, the movies that I like the best of the Coen brothers' work are not particularly successful. Right. And then some of the movies that, for a long time, their most successful movie was, financially, was Oh Brother, Where Art Thou?
Right.
And at the time of that's release, I found that the least interesting Coen Brother movie.
Yeah.
I like True Grit better than you did. I will agree, it's not as interesting, you know, it's not one of their more interesting films.
No.
But I felt a stronger emotional attachment to the girl, and I like the character arcs of both Rooster and the sheriff. Characters played by Matt Damon,
the Ranger,
that that they start out and
LaBeouf.
They both go through a fair number of changes where you're not shifting, and So I felt an emotional attachment to the character, but I'm with you that it's just, it's, you know, it's a genre piece executed by masters.
Mm-hmm.
So it's great. I mean, well, it's entertaining, and but I will agree with you that, and I don't necessarily know if True Grit is over. I almost feel like True Grit is only overrated by the Academy, to be honest, because the reviews of True Grit were positive, but not.
They weren't gushing.
They weren't gushing, and it hasn't won many other awards. No. Like, you know, it's been on people's top 10 lists, right. But none of the major critical awards or papers or anything across the country. I mean, I haven't seen anywhere where anyone has named True Grit Best Picture of the Year.
Right.
And so I guess in that
I actually have. I don't remember who it was. Okay. I think Ebert maybe even named it the Best Picture of the Year. I'm not 100% sure, but it has, you know, it's gotten decent reviews. One thing about True Grit that I have to say, and a little bit I have to respond to what you said. It's not that I didn't have an emotional connection to the girl, to Mattie Ross. I did. I liked her quite a bit. And that girl, Hailee Steinfeld, did a great, great job. I mean, she's really a natural actress. She's gonna have a great career. But what I think the movie failed to do was to establish a strong, powerful emotional connection between her and the Jeff Bridges character, Rooster Cogburn, at least the way it played out towards the end of the movie. It didn't quite, you know, I was expecting more than I got. And I have to say, just add another little thing. You know, there is another version of the novel, True Grit, with John Wayne. And a lot of people who don't like this True Grit really love the old True Grit. And just are kind of comparing it against the old film. I'm going to say right off the bat, I saw the old True Grit again literally a week ago. And it was terrible. I did not like it at all. I thought John Wayne gave a cloying, annoying, not very funny performance. I thought the girl was very good, but of course she was played by like a 25-year-old. So the whole thing just felt off and weird. And the movie itself is just, it's not shot very well. It doesn't seem to be taking place in the same location where it's supposed to be taking place. It seems to be way off, and it's very old-fashioned and very square. And just not very good. I don't think it holds up with its time. I think this True Grit is a better version of True Grit, and this True Grit may actually grow on me, and I think will hold up a lot better in subsequent viewing, while at the same time being still a very traditional Western without a lot of modernist touches.
No.
It's very straightforward like that. So True Grit, you know, it's... I have my reservations, but it's solid, and again, it's not going to win.
No,
I think it's a moot point. It's not. Yeah. I don't think it's going to win. What do you think is the favorite? Do you think there's a? Are you willing to make a prediction here of what's going to win Best Picture?
I don't know. I don't know what's going to win this year. I have to say, it more and more seems like a two-way race between The Social Network and The King's Speech.
Mm-hmm.
I have to say, at this point, I would be stunned if it was anything other than those two films.
Yeah, that I think that would be a huge
surprise.
Like
anything else would just be mind-blowing.
Right, it
and
would
I
be
mind-blowing.
And
I don't even necessarily think it's... People always talk in the acting categories about people splitting the vote and then a third dark horse comes in. I'd be stunned.
Right.
Right.
What would you like to see win? Let's say if another film does win outside of The Social Network and The King's Speech, what would you like be
well,
like?
Well, if I was voting, I'd vote for Winner's Bone. But I mean, if I was voting,
mm-hmm.
again, no way in hell Winner's Bone.
No.
It's not going to win.
It's not going to win. But
that's
boy,
what
it's
I would
good.
Vote for.
Boy, that's a good movie, right?
I mean, like, yeah.
That is a wonderful movie. It's this great film noir. It just has this, it's like classic detective noir set in this completely different environment that's kind of familiar, but not too familiar. Certainly not seen a lot in movies these days, or really at any time. And it has this great central performance. I mean, where like the main detective character, like you can imagine, like if this was a standard film noir in the 40s, this would be Humphrey Bogart looking for, you know, his father's killers or his father to say. And here you have like a 17-year-old girl doing it.
And to me, the other You know, this was the argument we had about Avatar last year, or there's a little bit every year, that, you know, there's a couple ways to look at the Best Picture nominee. That, you know, if you take it at face value, the Best Picture is supposed to be, I mean, the best artistic achievement, right? I mean, that's supposedly what the award is for.
Mm-hmm.
And you could say past winners like The Last Emperor. You know, whether or not you thought that was the best artistic movie of 1987, I mean, that was a movie that was not, you know, a huge box office hit.
Right.
Like, you know, when the general public looks back at 1987, they were like, oh, yeah, that was the year all anybody could talk about was The Last Emperor. I mean, that's not really the case.
No.
So, I mean, the other aspect of it is sometimes the Best Picture is, you know, sometimes is nominated and even awarded to the movie that best exemplifies that year. And, you know, a lot of people thought Avatar should have won last year just based on, you know, it was hard to argue that at least the end of 2009, that was the year of Avatar.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what people were seeing and talking about. And so when you, you know, earlier, Sam, when you look back at 2010, what are you going to remember? And, you know, it's probably not going to be the King's Speech. And based on that line of thinking, I mean, it's got to be Inception, right?
Well, it's either Inception or
The Social Network. Yeah.
I think those two films, and I think because Inception is a far more flawed film, I think Social Network absolutely deserves to win. I think at the end of the day, it's the best film of the year.
And it was,
it's the buzziest film. It was a successful film. It has all the elements that should put it on top. And if The King's Speech wins, it'll be sort of to the detriment of the Academy and the Oscars as a as an institution if Social Network ends up losing to The King's Speech, because, like you said, The Social Network has entered the kind of the subconscious of the country. I mean, people talked about Social Network. It was a subject of conversation, debate, and still is. It made tons of money. It was stylistically interesting, even though people who criticize it say, well, it was all talk and blah, 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 all that people just talking blah, 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 very fast. True, but there was something about the way all of that was handled that was very, very daring and very avant-garde and very intelligent and very stylistically interesting. And David Fincher deserves an enormous amount of credit for that, and the writer of the film deserves an enormous amount of credit for that. It better friggin' win, Steve. But if it didn't, if it didn't, it better not be The King's Speech that beats it. I'd love to see Winterbone, but if not Winterbone, at least The Fighter, because The Fighter is so damn entertaining and enjoyable, and I think people will love The Fighter in the same, or at least a similar way people love Rocky, which did win Best Picture.
Yeah. And but that's, I mean, my personal relationship with the Oscars, too. I mean, the only reason I would disagree with you about the integrity of the Oscars being compromised is that I'm like, compromised further? I mean, we're talking about an institution.
They've been redeeming themselves, Steve. They've been redeeming themselves lately.
Yes and no, but we're still talking about an organization that, you know, that several of the past winners and, you know, just past 15 years, we've got The English Patient, Gladiator, and Crash.
Right.
All of which I think they would like to have a little redo on.
Well, you know, I love Gladiator, but for completely different reasons that you know, the Academy should love Gladiator.
Yeah.
But I guess, you know, I'm with you. There's been a, I think Oscars have been redeeming themselves.
Yeah.
I think lately the Oscars really try to award the Best Picture award to films that had real artistic integrity and push the medium forward. And we've kind of seen that in the past few years. And like him or not, you know, but if a movie like King's Speech wins this year, regardless of the fact that it may be a fine and very, very beautifully done picture, I think it's going to be obvious that a lot of lobbying by Harvey Weinstein can get just about anything the Best Picture, regardless of what it's up against. And I think it'll be kind of scandalous, in my opinion. And I really, really hope that doesn't happen. I hope The Social Network gets it.
2010, like any year, there's some good, there's some bad. Tarantino once said that every year, it seems like there's one kind of masterpiece or near masterpiece. There's at least one film that stands the test of time. And he said, if you're looking for more than that, then maybe you're being greedy.
Yeah.
So as long as there's at least one movie a year, you're like, That's fine.
Yeah, I think this is a good crop, actually, to be honest with you. I think that...
Kind of redeemed itself towards the end of the year.
That's it for Spoiler Alert. I'm Andre Shane.
I'm Steve Askin.